Martin Heidegger claimed that idle talk is something that anyone can take up, which releases one from the task of genuinely understanding. He wrote of public disclosedness of being with one another, where the loudest idle talk and the most ingenious curiosity keeps things moving, where, in an everyday manner, everything and at bottom nothing is happening. We have a different view. We believe that the only way to reach the truth is by talking. Like a man panning for gold in a dung heap, in amongst the blither blather, bad puns and nonsense, one might find a single grain of truth. This is Idle Talk. Open your mind and then your mouth.
Good evening, this is Idle Talk. My name is Rod, as we are broadcasting live from Plato's Cave. An hour of philosophical talk and argumentation, which is the word for argument that is, well, spurious and should be taken out of the dictionary, in my opinion. Tonight, we are talking about the concept of beauty. We can all say, "Whoa, she's beautiful," etc. And we can all point out things that are beautiful. But what do these things have in common? What do we know about this concept? Where does it come from? How can we have such strong opinions on what's beautiful? And joining me tonight in the co-host corner, someone who I think is a bit better qualified, what with being an illustrator, etc., to talk about this, is a freelance illustrator, real arty type. Nicola, hello, you all right?
Yay!
Hello. Nicola. I know, right? What's it all this beauty thing about? Because lots of things get called beauty, things that really have not that much in common. Like a landscape can be beautiful, a person, and football is the beautiful game. I've never really understood that one.
Is it though? Is it really?
I know. Well, it depends on your conception of beauty, doesn't it? Because perhaps what are they doing there? What's a beautiful goal?
Oh yeah, I was going to say, you can go, "That was a beautiful goal."
And really, they're sort of remarking upon the skill to which that goal was executed, isn't it? It's, that's what makes it beautiful. Ooh, goal. So if anyone is a football supporter and can explain what is... Because they're not, let's face it, Wayne Rooney is not aesthetically beautiful, is he?
I don't think even a ball going into a net can be aesthetically beautiful, can it?
What if it was painted silver and had loads of glitter all over it?
Maybe.
Would that just make it beautiful?
You've done that too many times. We've been on air for about a minute and you've already done that three times.
I've broken the One Direction button to the point that it just sounds like this.
I got so frustrated with myself, I grunted. Very angrily.
See, that's what happens. One Direction soon sort of regress into Cher Lloyd. So, enough of this.
Have you got any good ones
this
there?
This is meant to be a credible philosophy show and we've already played One Direction to death. It's a weird one, isn't it? Because a football can be beautiful, but that's not beautiful. That's beautiful because I think they're remarking upon the skill of, say, Beckham taking a penalty. And that is amazingly skillful.
I don't think anybody actually thinks that's beautiful, though, do they?
Do you think that's a turn of phrase?
I think it's like when someone says, "Oh, that was ill," or "That was sick." Stop fiddling around with my mic and my levels and my headphones and everything.
You weren't talking into it. So sorry, you were saying.
I think it's just like it's a turn of phrase. I don't think anybody actually looks at it and it brings a tear to their eye because they think it's really beautiful. Does it?
Maybe that's just a turn of phrase and we should probably ignore that. It's like, yeah, it is like saying something is sick or ill, man, isn't the same as "Oh, mate, Snoop Dogg was really sick last night. That means he put on a good performance. He didn't vomit all over the stage," a la Patrick Wolf. Patrick Wolf, when he performed at Reading Festival the other year, really was sick all over the place.
He's beautiful. I adore Patrick Wolf.
See, what makes him beautiful?
He is beautiful.
It's the way it was. Is it hairstyle?
I don't know if he's just got that face.
So he looks beautiful, but then we call a landscape beautiful. I think that's a parallel, isn't it? Because it's both things we look at. It's both visual stimuli.
His face is like a landscape.
Is it?
Skin.
So we want to know, like, where does this come from? Because we all are very, very opinionated about beauty, and not all people find the same things beautiful. Like, if you spend like an evening with a load of men in a pub, there is a matter of time before they start sort of doing female friend top trumps. They go, "Oh, she's beautiful," and someone like, "No, she's too short. No, don't like the way she looks." And there'll be massive discrepancies between the tastes of the men and the sort of women they're attracted to.
So don't look at me for confirmation. I've not experienced this.
But girls do the same thing. They talk about blokes in that manner.
I don't have like an album on my phone entitled "Male Friends."
But you know, I bet women discuss men. And they discuss
like headshots.
They discuss the aesthetics of men. Generally, I think that's a.
I guess. Well, we just did, didn't we? So yeah.
Yeah. So what does? Where does this idea come from? We're going to explore two different theories. One is an evolutionary explanation. It's been hardwired into our brain by natural selection, so we're sort of evolutionarily programmed for survival of the fittest to find certain things attractive because it is better, more beneficial overall for the survival of our species. And then we're looking at a more sort of cultural / biological approach, which says our conception of beauty is dictated by our education and our upbringing. So if you had just don't think about this too much. It's nice to get with it's nice with philosophy to talk about it in sort of the naive sense, as in just give your gut reaction, because sometimes people's gut reactions to things can be very, very interesting and much more. Because you can, if you read too much philosophy, I think you can become blinded to it. You can become sort of pigeonholed into one way of thinking. Like I was in the pub last night with my mate Stuart, and I asked my mate Stuart about the conception of beauty, and he goes, "Oh well, it's culture. It's in our culture." And the Stuart didn't study philosophy, yet he's basically echoed what an awful lot of supposedly very clever people have written about. So philosophy is out there, and we all do it to a degree without even sort of realising. So without too much thought, just let us know in the chat box, oneradio.org/S. Where do we get our idea of beauty from? Do we learn it? Were we born it? Is it a matter of choice? You know, whatever you think it might be, just write it in the chat box now. Or even better, you can call me on Skype at any time. My Skype name is rodders.com, RHODDERS. And we look forward to hearing your views after this very short break. This is Idle Talk.
Idle Talk on One Radio.
This is Idle Talk on oneradio.org with myself, Rodders, and you're Nicola.
I am still Nicola.
Tonight we are talking about beauty. We're going to have a look in a minute at Dennis Dutton's theory on this. He has a Darwinian approach to it. Basically, it's evolution hardwired an idea of what is beautiful. Didn't do the One Direction joke that time, notice.
Because the button's broken.
I know, right? So we're basically talking, we're going to talk about the evolutionary idea behind beauty. But then meanwhile, we're just wanting some general thoughts. We had a few bits and bobs in the chat box, but before we go to those, hello, Kieran, you're on the show.
Hello.
Hello, Kieran, how's it going?
Not too bad, thanks. You?
So, sort of doing this radio show in a metaphysical cave somewhere. With internet access. Plato's cave has extremely reliable Wi-Fi, touch wood. So, beauty, where do you think it comes from?
Well, I'm going to go for the really cynical approach here. Okay. And say it's something that's been socially constructed, as in it's been what a few people who run magazines see as like desirable, I think.
Okay, but didn't before magazines, there were cave people who told them they presumably had a conception of beauty. They drew cave paintings. They were attracted to each other purely, probably few beauty. I think a cave woman who was more aesthetically pleasing, bigger boulders, etc. That is ridiculous. Can't believe I said that. We'll fix that in the edit. Would more likely attract a mate. So where they didn't have magazines. Ugg the caveman couldn't read Hello magazine.
Well, I think what you could see is there's like the people that are sort of at the top, the elite type of people, perhaps, and what they saw as sort of something that would get them in a better position, that type of thing. So I think in some ways it could be partially to do with something that is seen in the eye of the beholder and some sort of quality in the person themselves.
Okay, so you're saying we sort of have some idea ourselves just based on our own subjective viewpoint, but our subjective viewpoint is strongly influenced by, say, magazines. Nicola here, a part of your job, you design a lot of greetings cards with like flowers on and all sorts of pretty things, things that are meant to be beautiful. Is Nicola part of this elite telling us what beautiful is? What do you think, Nicola?
I probably am, I guess. Am I? No, I'm not. I'm following. People give me... Okay, so when I have... when someone gives me a brief to work to, they will send me a trend board, which has sort of what's in fashion at the moment, and I have to work towards those things. So like at the moment, you've got like Aztec prints and neons and things like that. So I have to include them in my design because that's what's fashionable. So I guess to an extent, the whole magazine thing is probably right.
But wait, but Karen, so you don't think magazines are dictating this sort of fashion, and now Nicola's a sheep. Why didn't I load up a sheep?
Professional sheep.
Yeah. But then magazines, people have to buy them. They only make these magazines because there's a market to buy them. So what came first? There must have been. We must have wanted glamour magazines, otherwise there wouldn't have been a market to sell them to. So how can you claim that this elite, the magazine editors decide beauty?
Well, it's not necessarily just for magazines, to be honest. That was just sort of one example, because I think there's a time where just a lot of people get influenced by one person saying, this is the norm, you've got to follow it. I think that's the whole thing with beauty in the first place.
I guess certainly in fashion, it seems to be whoever is people buy. Like when Cheryl Cole wore that funny, it's sort of a fur hat with a hole in the top. What are they called, Nicola? Do you have any idea?
I don't think there's a professional name. Ear warmers?
Those stupid furry head. Basically, an impractical hat. The whole point of a hat is that it stops your head getting cold, but this had a hole in the top where most of the heat, very inefficient. But as soon as Cheryl Cole wore one of those, because she's exposed and has lots of fans, a lot of people then started, you know, one of my friends just suddenly turned up wearing one the week after Cheryl Cole had been seen on The X Factor with one. So I guess I sort of take your point. Thanks very much for the call, Kieran.
No problem, thanks.
Cheers. Also, we missed a call from Les. Les, if you want to call back at some point, that would be wonderful. But, you know, I wasn't going to do, like, a conference call. I wasn't going to turn this into some sort of business meeting. But that's an interesting one, isn't it? Where is it some sort of... So there they are erring towards some sort of social construct. But then it's very hard to tell where it begins. It's almost like a chicken versus egg sort of cliche, isn't it? It's because it's Cheryl Cole or someone fashionable is fashionable because they're topical, because they're riding a wave of trend, or are they trendsetter? Do you know what I mean? What made them? Famous because they are so unique and we think, wow, that's a good thing to be, or are they conforming to such a degree that we all see them as sort of the ideal, I guess? We've got another call. Hello, Les, you're on the show.
Hello, Rodus, how are you doing? Hello, yeah. Nicola.
Hello.
Yeah, no, we're good.
Yeah. I just think I think we're born with it to a certain extent. There's got to be some sort of instinct that takes you in that right direction, hasn't there? It can't be all down to what we learn. But I do think you're right in what you say, where it's what you see as well. It's what you're brought up to see. So what you're shown around you, like you say, media, catalogues, things like that, are all influences towards what you already know. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I think you might be. This really isn't my area of expertise. I shunned the module on aesthetics at uni. But I think you might be onto something, Les, because we're going to go on to a guy named Dennis Dutton. He provides some sort of evolutionary example. So, like, so we could be born with some sort of hardwired ideal of beauty. And then maybe, if that's true, everything else, like beauty magazines, fashion trends, all sort of spawn originally from that.
Yeah, well, if you think about it from an animal point of view, I know this is probably a bit crude for some people, but if you think of it from an animal point of view, all animals have to breed, and for whatever reason, they're attracted to a mate, be it a male or a female, for whatever reason. So it's got to be hardwired, doesn't it? It's got to be something that's instinct. Otherwise, that would never happen, and certain breeds of animal would die out rather rapidly, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah, and the wimpy animals always die out. Like the blooming dodo, they were so stupid that a lot of them died out, and therefore there were less of them to breed, whereas more successful animals... So take a bull, for example. It's the strongest bulls survive. And like, flying above my house all the time, we have red kites, these birds of prey, and it's always the strongest kite that manages to fight off the other males and get the girlfriend. It's always him that gets to, that I see taking girls to the cinema Saturday night at the movies. Who cares what picture you see? There's a blooming red kite sitting in the row behind you. But you know what I mean? It's like they are attractive to the female part of the species, and also they're able to fend off the rest of the
kite. I love a good red kite.
I know, right?
That's all we all.
Is that it's always me next to them at the cinema.
Let's face it, with a name like Dodo, you're not going to go very far, are you?
No, you're not. I don't think they chose the name, though. Nicola, is that why you dyed your hair red, to be more attractive to red kites?
Yeah, definitely.
It is. So, Les, what is beauty for you? if you had to put down one thing that was
for
beauty,
me, it's kind of hard to say, isn't it? I couldn't put my finger on one thing. I don't think it would be impossible.
Awesome. No, I think that's a sensible approach. It tends to encompass a whole range of things. Thanks very much for the call, Les.
Hi, welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
Cheers, Les. Yeah, Les, pretty much echoing what Dennis Dutton's about to say. And we'll go into detail that after we... hang on, we're going to take one more. We get the phones are going absolutely berserk this evening. We're going to take one more call. Hello, Rachel, you're on the show.
Hello.
Hello, Rachel. How's it going?
I'm good, thank you, Rodri. How are you?
Yeah, not so bad. Where do you think we get this idea of beauty from, then?
I think there's a couple of factors for originally. There's some things from... evolutionary psychology, and that things like high contrast and things like that, which attract the eye, help babies look at eyes, and they sort of, that tendency stays with us for the rest of our life. But then if you think about beauty as in painting or something, for example, a portrait originally was what prosperity and things like larger women and stuff could afford to eat, thus the idea of beauty came from things like that. But I'm not sure how that translates into noun things, because obviously it takes a big leap, doesn't it, into abstract painting and things like that.
Do you think beauty is too wide a term? Because we call a lot of things beautiful, like people can be beautiful, a bit of art can be beautiful, and a landscape can be beautiful. Do you think it'd be helpful if they, like, I don't know, sub-categorised these things?
Well, no, not at all. I think it's the same idea for all of them, that something attracts your eye, which your eye wants to stay on it, and things. That's exactly the same for a landscape, to a person. Obviously, you're using a wildly different criteria for each one, but the idea of, you know, wanting to keep looking and keep being interested and engaged in the visual format is exactly the same.
Thanks very much, Rachel. This is Idle Talk, and we're going to go for a short break. Then after the break, we're going to delve more into detail. Basically, we're going to expand upon what Les was saying about how probably there's some sort of reason to do with our survival and our ancient ancestors that we find certain things attractive. I still find the beautiful... I wish I'd asked Les about that, about the beautiful game. I find that a very, very peculiar phrase. This is Idle Talk, live to the world on oneradio.org.
Idle Talk on One Radio.
This is Idle Talk. Tonight's topic is the concept of beauty. And you know, One Direction wrote a really quite powerful thesis on this. So
button's broken. Don't play it.
I won't. Don't worry. Now, so we've done that joke to death. So let's look at Dennis Dutton, A Darwinian Theory of Beauty. He basically said that we seem to have these cultural universals. Shakespeare is translated all over the world. People think Mozart is wonderful in loads of different countries. American movies, they're very, very sort of culturally... they just sort of spread everywhere, doesn't it? Like some yee-haw in virus all over everyone knows who John Wayne is, etc. And so there's some sort of thing we find beautiful that we all have in common. Regardless, like, our cultures can be incredibly different. Like, I live a totally different life to someone, say, in China, but we could probably both admire a beautiful flower, for example. That's what I do. I ogle flowers in my free time. Yeah. I wonder how Dennis Dutton tried to explain this by he sort of worked backwards to construct a Darwinian evolutionary history of aesthetic tastes, basically how these sort of tastes became engraved in our mind. It's like that. It's the same as any Darwinian adaptation, he says. Like, for example, we have a natural revulsion to, say, rotting meat. You wouldn't eat... If I gave you a bit of rotting meat, you'd go, "Oh, God, not eating that!" Oh, unless you said, "Oh, double dare you!" Then the bloke, sort of the primitive bloke instinct comes out and they ignores the evolutionary ones, but never mind, we won't discuss that. But you've got a natural revulsion, and that makes perfect sense, because if you did eat rotting meat a lot, you would die. So the people who ate the rotting meat died out, and the people who didn't survived it and bred, and then their offspring had inbuilt into them this revulsion for rotting meat. And same goes for the fear of loud noises that we all suffer from, the fear of fire, the fear of heights, etc. So that's basically generally how evolution works, and Dutton applies this to our aesthetic tastes.
Yeah, like on the other side, like peacock's tails everybody thinks peacock's tails are beautiful, and the point of that is so they can attract and make things like that.
Yeah, because in many respects they're totally impractical, because if you go around with a massive tail like that, you're a target for predators. It's like wearing a bullseye.
Yeah, he was saying that the sexual attraction thing goes against normal animal evolution, which is like making them blend into backgrounds and things. So making them beautiful is even more powerful than that they've evolved with that attribute rather than one that would make them blend into the crowd.
Espy says, is beauty biochemical based then? I don't know. I couldn't say. I guess, does evolution work by having different sort of chemical reactions in the brain? I guess if I'm revolted by something, there must be a different, there's less endorphin. Because if I'm pleased by something, I have a very loose grasp of this, but I think endorphins go off in my head.
Yeah, they do.
And like we naturally, from evolution, we like sugary things because we needed those to keep us alive. Now we overindulge ourselves, so I wonder if eventually we'll have a revulsion to these things because they're unhealthy. Well, that doesn't seem to be happening though. Maybe that's an argument against evolution, but that's like people just seem to be getting fatter and fatter, don't they? So they're just eating all the wrong things, and they don't. Why isn't evolution just sort of shouting, "Stop eating all those crisps, you idiot! You're killing yourself!" I mean, I guess it's a different topic, isn't it? So we'll come up. Maybe we should do a whole show on evolution. I can't believe we haven't done that because it's a very controversial and influential theory. It's got huge ramifications for all sorts of areas of philosophy, including free will, and obviously like there's huge religious ramifications for it as well, if you're a creationist, etc. Good topic for another day, I think. But so they're saying that if endorphins go off in my mind because I'm eating something sweet, maybe same things happen with the peahens and the peacock.
Even in human instances, we find back when fair ladies used to be perceived as really beautiful because they were the rich ones that didn't have to do with gardening and stuff.
Yeah,
and
Rachel was saying that if you were overweight, it was seen as a sign of affluence, and therefore that was seen as attractive.
Yeah, all like I read a lot of Victorian novels, and they talk about people being plump as if like it's a really sexy thing, and it's so weird to read that, and I have to reprogram my brain to think, okay, so that's a good thing.
If I went into a bar, whoa, you look plump.
I know, it's not good anymore.
I'd get slapped, wouldn't I? It would not end well.
Because now everybody can afford, most people can afford to eat well enough to get plump. I mean, you get working class people that are plump, you would say.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's the other way around. Now it seems to be, being unhealthy and overweight is now a sign of poverty because they're only affording to buy the poorer quality food.
So
that wouldn't be an evolutionary thing. This is like cultural and social things. Maybe there's some sort of, maybe you have the evolutionary hardwiring and then all this cultural stuff, like seeing people who are plumper as richer and therefore attractive, then gets chucked as well. So we generate our own conception of beauty and chuck that on top of our already sort of instinctual evolutionary conceptions of beauty.
Yeah, and like in the 1920s, people with a frame like mine, sort of straight up and down women with no sort of curves, used to be attractive, and people used to wear the sort of clothes that showed that figure off. And now it's kind of the opposite, like curvaceous women are coming back into fashion again.
Yeah, now it's...
I guess you could put that down to the whole fair women being able to afford to stay inside. People that can afford breast implants and, you know, bum implants and things like that. I guess you could subconsciously sort of... say that's the same sort of thing happening
I might get one of those, because then every single seat I would sit on would be comfortable if my bum was just larger.
I wouldn't have to carry a cushion anywhere I go ever again. It would be great.
Yeah, it would be great, wouldn't it? You'd sit in the most uncomfortable places. Sitting on the floor of a train, say, when it was crowded, would be just as good as probably better than sitting on those terrible seats. Oh, God, well, we're going on well, sidetracked by a train, eh? But it is weird, like, it used to be very, very fashionable to be pale, and now people spend a lot of money fake tanning themselves.
Exactly, because now it's fashionable to go away on holiday, and you look like you're rich if you've got a tan because you've been to a nice country.
Yeah, whereas I guess in Victorian times when being pale was the norm,
didn't travel.
Was that
so
because,
much.
I guess that was because that showed they didn't have to work because they were rich,
yeah.
So they didn't have to get a suntan.
Yeah, because they've got slaves in the garden, so they're the ones with the tanned hands. And, you know, women have really long nails these days, and that's because they don't have to do anything because they've got servants to do everything. that you couldn't do if you had really long nails.
Well, nowadays, did you say?
Yeah.
What do you mean
I mean, it's not like people don't go and get their nails done because they're like, I want people to think I don't have to work. But subconsciously, that thing goes off in your brain that you're like, oh, they obviously don't have
the fashion still remains, yeah. But we've forgotten the reason. So they just think, oh, well, of course I get my nails done.
Yeah.
I think there's a peacock element with that as well, because your eyes are drawn to fancy
exactly.
nails.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Another thing, like, talking about cave paintings as being the earliest form of art, another thing this Dutton chap was saying is back sort of millions of years before that, people used to make, you know, the really earliest forms of humans used to make these axe things that were really beautiful.
Yeah.
And
they made so many of them, there's no way they were all going to be used for slaughtering animals.
And they used to make them far too elaborate for them to actually be useful. And the sort of the evolutionary reason for people thinking those are beautiful is because it's a sign of skill. And they were the ones that attracted the mates because they were the strong ones and stuff.
Yeah, is there any universals between fashion? Because you've got women being pale, then now they're meant to be tanned, and now men. What's fashionable for men now? I don't. You see, being an unfashionable person, I don't know. Because men are victims of fashion, but not to the extent that women are.
I guess men's fashion
could go down the gender and feminist route, but we're not doing that topic tonight. So
I guess it's becoming a lot more effeminate. I don't know
what you could
say about
tighter
that.
Tighter jeans, etc. The cut of jeans is changing. Is there any things that are always attractive? I was going to say maybe it's always attractive to have a tough man, but then you get women who don't necessarily go for that. And you do. It seems to be much more mixed up
perhaps,
now, doesn't it?
Maybe it's something to do with gender roles becoming more equalised, and maybe women don't want a man that's quite so manly anymore, and the... You know, women are wearing more manly things and men are wearing more effeminate things.
Maybe, I guess
it's becoming more androgynous.
Oh, God, what am I going to do with my massive, like, 12-inch biceps now? They're useless. All that work.
All that work.
I know, right? But maybe, and also maybe it's because we aren't fighting for our survival. It's no longer necessary to have a strong man to protect you.
Well, women like to think of themselves as being strong themselves now, so I think perhaps they don't want to
and we're not
be
being
dominated.
We're not having to fight buffaloes. We go to Tesco or Waitrose, don't you? You don't have to fight for your food. We're not constantly under attack all the time. Well, maybe if you live somewhere dreadful, maybe you are. But yeah, you know I mean, like, we're not constantly having to defend ourselves from marauding.
Not in Waitrose, maybe like, Asda. You have to fight.
Fight off tribes. Yeah. Maybe if you go to Asda, it is really just like going back to the primitive state of the what's it called? I want to say Plasticine. Isn't the Plasticine era? It's not, is it?
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's Plasticine Man. I'm saying it wrong. It's the sort of like prehistoric age. But when I heard it, I just thought of Morph, the little man. I thought that's where he comes from, the Plasticine age.
Okay.
But yeah, so that maybe there is some sort of... Dutton also says that beauty is nature's sort of way of acting at a distance. That's why the peacock isn't very practical, the tail isn't very practical, but from a distance it's useful for attracting people. And he says that why do we find landscapes attractive? This is where I think I can attack Dutton a bit. I think this is becoming a bit tenuous.
I get stuck when it comes to landscapes. I can't explain why that would be an evolutionary
thing. Whoa, look at those mountains!
I know.
Whoa, look at the size of those.
You get the peacock tail and the demonstration of skill and, oh, he's a strong man, so he can look after me. But nature, why are we conditioned to love the way a hillside looks?
Yeah, that is really odd, isn't it? And Dutton's explanation is that we like these landscapes because they happen to be similar to the environment that our ancestors grew up in back in the prehistoric times. That just seems to be stretching it that little bit too far, doesn't it? Because
I don't know, that's not necessary, is it really?
Because you can find it, you know, like he's sort of looking at savannas and trees and all that sort of lovely thing. But look, I look over London. I went up, for example, not so long ago, I went up Tower Bridge at night time and you could see the entire of London just spread out before you like some sort of massive light up carpet. And that was beautiful. There is beauty. And prehistoric man he didn't have to get the underground. He wasn't living in London, was he?
Perhaps it's like a homing instinct. Maybe it's...
But there's something, I find cities beautiful because they're so impressive and they're glitzy and they're decadent, they're exciting, there's a sense of, there's an atmosphere, I don't know. And look outside the window now. There's a beautiful sunset over where we are
now.
Hey,
there is.
if you look outside the mouth of Plato's cave, there is the real world and the sunset.
Don't look.
Do we have any cave paintings in Plato's cave, or would that be like vandalism of a monument? Would be, wouldn't it? Do you know, apparently Plato's olive tree in Greece, where he used to teach under, apparently got run over by some Greek in a truck. They crashed a truck into it. Brilliant, isn't it?
Nice.
Oh dear. Mm. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent.
The landscape thing, I feel like it must be it's what you're used to. It makes you feel like home sweet home, kind of. It makes you feel safe.
I don't know if it does, because if I went to Africa, I've never been there. I've never lived anywhere like that, but I'd find it beautiful.
That's my issue with that. But then, I don't know.
Yeah, that is we're completely stumped on. If anyone has any ideas on that, we've had loads of messages coming in. Thanks for your comments. Keep them coming. We'll try and get to as many of them. We spotted some good ones earlier, Nicola.
Let me have a look. Hang on. DJ Simon says the concept of beauty changed when he became a Christian. I started seeing all things as beautiful rather than the shallow world description. That's interesting.
Yeah, so maybe the beauty is determined. Is that the? I don't want to put words into your mouth, but maybe if you believe God is the creator, then God, being a perfect being, created everything, and even man-made, that's sort of God by proxy. So therefore, everything a perfect being created must be in some respect beautiful.
If we would explain the landscape thing, I suppose, like, and all the evolutionary stuff that we've been talking about, the peacock tails and things like that, that would, you know, he would create those things to be beautiful.
Yeah, you're wondering at the majesty of God's creation. I guess that's an interesting take on things. What else has been going on in there? Quite a lot. DJ Simon says, perhaps if we saw things through the eyes of the creator, yeah, it's just adding on to what he said before, perhaps if we saw things through the eyes of the creator, that would offer a beauty as something created. That's an interesting take as well.
Apparently, cave paintings have been explained away by hallucinations caused by extended periods of light deprivation caused by being inside caves. Interesting.
This is a good one. Les is talking about beer goggles. You know, when you get so drunk, you find someone really ugly attractive. The classic beer goggles theory has been linked to something that is in our genetic makeup that's affected by alcohol. I wonder if Les is talking from empirical experience. Like, he goes out and experiments with alcohol. And
that's very noble of you, Les.
Well done.
Very noble.
Les doing his thing for philosophy and for science and mankind in his local pub. Brilliant.
We've got an Oscar Wilde quote, which I always appreciate.
Oh, go for it.
No object is so beautiful that under certain conditions it will not look ugly.
That sounds interesting.
We should have looked this up, actually. Oscar Wilde did a lot of good quotes about beauty.
Yeah, we should have done. Someone who's marring your careful quotes of words. I think that's when you were describing different shapes of women's body.
That was, yep.
Yeah. Tiptoeing around it, then not wanting to upset anyone.
No.
So... it's a really difficult one, because it's one of these topics that we all think we know, like, oh yeah, we know what beauty is, and then suddenly when you actually think about it, it just seems to be such a mess of different conflicting theories.
It's in the evolution of art that it gets really interesting, where you think about how it's a demonstration of skill, and when you look at all the old masters of the painting, people that could do really realistic landscapes and edit them according to the golden section, which was the theory that if you split things up into thirds, it's more pleasing to the eye and things like that.
And it seems to work. Law of averages says it works.
And yeah, you
it?
Do. You go around the Tate Britain and you look at some of the old masters' paintings there, and they're incredible. And you just, some of them, even if you're not educated in art, you look at them and think that's absolutely stunning.
Which sort of brings us on to the next theory we're going to discuss. It's a French name. Do you want to pronounce this?
Pierre Bourdieu
says.
I just did it. You didn't have to do it again. I'm better
sorry,
than you.
I should have put that on a soundboard and played it. But he sort of says that a lot of it is part of our education and upbringing. But before we get onto that, something I wanted to cover briefly. It's gone out of my head. Never mind. It's wonders of live radio, isn't it? Yeah, I think there is some weight to this evolutionary explanation. I think we're going to. Take a very, very short break. Then we're going to take another theory, which basically has a biological sociological take on things. So it's maybe this, because a lot of people tonight have been saying beauty's in the eye of the beholder, and that's the thing that's popping up an awful lot tonight. mostly because, well, it's saying beauty's subjective. So maybe beauty is something we create to a certain degree. So we're going to have a short break, and I'm going to play Elvis Costello, all this useless beauty, because it's blooming useless, doesn't serve any purpose, but makes my room look pretty. This is IdleTalk1Radio.org.
Idle Talk on One Radio.
Idle Talk with myself, Rodders, and Nicola, freelance illustrator extraordinaire.
See Hello.
Her work. Yeah, go see her work at nicolapatton.com.
Yes,
very nice stuff.
Do that.
Yeah, do it right now. There's a yeah.
Not right now, because you've got to listen to us.
Yeah, she follows some conceptions of beauty, I believe, in her work. And she got to, otherwise no one would buy them, would she? No one's going to buy something really ugly. But that sort of thing I was thinking about earlier. We all say beauty is something that we all look at, we're drawn to, but then we're drawn to the horrid as well. Like if you had Audrey Hepburn, someone who's typically, or Kate Moss, someone who's typically meant to be very, very beautiful. Kate Moss at a party. John Merrick, the elephant man, a hideously deformed man, is there. They would both get sort of equal amounts of people staring at them, but both sort of for different reasons. But they both kind of share there's still a sort of something novel to look at. And I can't really see the difference between the abhorrent and the beautiful in that sense.
I think this is what we were saying before about the old masters having, you know, their displaying of skill, and everybody thought that was beautiful. Art now has progressed to a state where quite often what you see in galleries isn't like that anymore. It's people that you get Damien Hirst, who's cut a shark in half. That's not beautiful. You wouldn't see that in a gallery and think that's beautiful. But you'd stare at it like you'd stare at the Elephant Man, I guess.
Because
it attracts your attention.
Yeah, I went to the Portrait Gallery Friday it was. Mark Quinn made a sculpture out of himself with his own blood. It's there just hanging in a frozen case, and it's basically...
Was it beautiful?
No, it was quite horrible, but it was fascinating. It was basically a big blood pudding or scab, wasn't it? But I stared at that for longer than anything else in that gallery, so there was some sort of morbid fixation, and I'd stare at that in the same way I would a beautiful bit of art. Anyway, we can't really digress into this much more. We've got to get into another theory. Pierre Bourdieu came up with a theory, basically a sociological attempt at explaining it.
I think, this kind of goes along with it, really, that rather than us being evolutionarily conditioned to find things beautiful, it's something that we're educated into. And so people like me, who've been at college studying art for 3 years, will have been taught about these things, like the golden section I was talking about earlier with the theory of thirds and things like that. And if something's in the shape of like an eye, sort of oval shape, we'll find that beautiful. There was an artist called Caspar David Friedrich that I really like, who did a load of that. And his paintings are visually stunning to look at, and nobody really knows why, so they've come up with these theories to explain it. And so his theory is that we're conditioned by culture and the way we learn at school and things to find things like that beautiful.
It's weird, isn't it? Because, like, I'm going to pull out a quote here. He says, artwork has meaning and interest only for someone who possesses the cultural competence that is the code to which it was encoded. So if I went to a gallery, I would get a lot less out of it than you, because you know the techniques and you can appreciate it on a probably a higher level. I'd just be thinking, oh, that looks nice. Where you?
I don't know if I agree with that. I've got another quote here that he said, a beholder who lacks the specific code feels lost in a chaos of sound and rhythms, colours and lines without rhyme or reason.
I did get lost in the portrait gallery, but I was trying to find the loo, so that's maybe a
but
different
do you, issue. Okay, so you don't know who Caspar David Friedrich is, I would imagine.
No idea.
But if you look at... Imagine any old master's painting that you can think of. If
Monet's
you,
Water Lilies.
Okay, yeah, so if you look at that, you'd think that's beautiful.
Right.
I don't think I'd look at that and think that's any more beautiful than you would.
But I don't think I'd appreciate it as much. I wouldn't think... You'd probably think that I can't quantify beauty. You'd think it's really beautiful. I think, oh, it's quite nice.
I guess maybe I'd look at it and think, I like the way that...
You could look at it for longer. I just think, that's all right, isn't it? That's like me flicking for a photo album.
Okay, so maybe I would look at it and think, even though the dominant colours are purples and blues, I like the way that he's put some yellows in there that you can't really see immediately, but it reflects the presence of light. So I'd see something like that and you wouldn't. But I think, I don't know if you'd feel lost in a chaos of colours and lines, would you?
I don't know. I think that's really insulting. It sounds kind of elitist, but let's try and interpret this in a charitable way. Maybe he's just exaggerating for poetic effect. But also, there does seem to be something very, very elitist about this. And he seems to say that your education will have an influence on it, but it's your upbringing, your family background. If your family always go to the theatre, for example, then that's the only way you can appreciate it. Which kind of seems to say that if someone came from a totally non-cultural, my family, I think we're a bit cultured, right? We go to the theatre, etc.
My
mum, when I was 9, took me to the Tate Modern. To be fair, my mum laughed at a lot of the things because we didn't understand them. But like, my mum's quite arty, and my dad likes music a lot, etc. So I've been brought up to accept cultural things and have an interest in it, whereas some households are never brought up. It's not in their paradigm to go to the theatre.
I find it much more comfortable to agree with something like that, I think.
So maybe it's... But he seems to be saying that if you didn't have a cultural upbringing, you couldn't then go and learn it later and then learn to appreciate art later, which I think it doesn't seem... Because you're less likely to go on and appreciate art, but it doesn't mean that someone from a totally uncultured background can't appreciate it at some stage.
I think you're right there, and I also think that these theories and stuff that I've learnt in my education are more a way of explaining why we find things beautiful as opposed to teaching us how to find things beautiful.
Yeah, I don't know, because maybe to make some sort of conclusion you'd have to combine the ever, because some of this is like, you cannot deny that upbringing is important, you cannot deny that I don't understand, maybe I've interpreted this wrong, but did you get the sense that he like I said, he held upbringing over education to a very, very large degree? I'm going to change my mind. I think is he right? Because if you're brought up to not consider art to be worthwhile, or even to think that theatre's rubbish, and you go to school and a teacher tries to tell you that theatre's worthwhile, you're going to be less likely to go along with that.
I feel like...
So maybe he's right.
I agree with the upbringing thing. I think it makes it more accessible if you've been brought up into an environment that takes kids to see galleries and things. So I agree with that bit. I think it's the emphasis he put on the education that I find uncomfortable, because I think it's more important, the rules and things are important in your understanding of beauty rather than your access to perceiving beauty. I don't think you find things ugly if you're not taught that they're beautiful.
Yeah, because maybe it's different levels, and maybe the upbringing, because maybe we could combine the two theories that we've done tonight, sort of bodge them together. You've got an evolutionary kind of instinct of what is beautiful, and then this is also, of course, influenced by cultural things such as your education and your background. Perhaps.
I think, yeah, like modern art, I think you do have to be educated to find it,
because
they're going
away from the original old conceptions of beauty.
That's more into finding something art, like you have to be taught that something's art. I can see that.
And the what is art debate is something we'll save for another night, I think.
But I think if you have to be taught that something's beautiful, it's not beautiful.
I don't know. I really thought we should get to... I wonder if Katy Perry wrote anything profound about this. So I don't know. Because people say Katy Perry's beautiful, and people say... landscapes are beautiful. So beauties are very... I wonder if you could, like I said to Rachel earlier, whether you could break beauty down and treat the... Does it make sense to say a landscape's beautiful and a person's beautiful? Could you break those two things down into different types of beauty? Then you wouldn't have this problem of this, well, why do I find Kate Moss attractive, and why do I think that beautiful landscape is well fit?
Yeah, I think you need a separation between natural beauty and elitist artistic beauty, in inverted commas.
Because one is we found maybe some things we find beauty, and then some things we're told beautiful. Because, of course, if you don't find Monet's water lilies beautiful, then you're some sort of philistine. Maybe that's it, some sort of idiot. Maybe that's a sort of elitist conception. I don't know, it's a very confusing one. But to draw some sort of conclusion, I'd say evolution has its impact. And that seems plausible up until the point of the landscapes, and it becomes a little more tenuous. So I think it's our conception of beauty is a massive... mishmash of our own personal feelings influenced by our upbringing and our cultural surroundings and
education. The education and the theories are there to try to understand why we find these things beautiful rather than to try and teach us that they are.
Yeah, but perhaps it's a weird one, isn't it? But this has been an interesting topic tonight. You've been listening to Idle Talk. Thanks very much for all your comments. We'll be back next week with another mind-boggling topic. Next week, tune in, because I'm having a very special co-host, someone who hasn't been on the air with me for, I think, about 2 years. Someone, if you are a hardcore, I guess, Rodhead, they call themselves, if you're an avid listener to my radio programs, then you might remember this character. So or person, not a character. It's not just me putting on a voice for an hour. Don't worry. So tune in next week, same time, 9 p.m. UK time, on oneradio.org. And please write me an iTunes review. I say this and very few people bother. Thank you if you have done. Go to iTunes, type in Idle Talk, give us a nice review, because it really ups the amount of downloads we get. And also, we are available on Audioboo at audioboo.fm/idletalk. So please spread the word. The show is getting better and better by the day, thanks to all your help. So thanks, Nicola.
Thank you.
This has been Idle Talk. Good night.